The Articulate Coven is the original, unofficial podcast and fan community for Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire and Anne Rice's Immortal Universe from AMC and AMC+. Welcome to The Articulate Coven. We're your hosts. I'm Joel.
I'm Ashley.
And we are The Articulate Coven. And we're back, Ashley, with a birthday bonus episode. As we release this episode, it is your birthday. Happy birthday, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm very excited. I've been looking forward to discussing this particular work for quite a while.
Well, and I think it is exactly the palate cleanser that we need after our last recording.
Oh, Lord.
I love Nicholas Danielson on our Facebook page just posted the description of the last episode where it explains that we do a commentary track on Queen of the Damned. Dear Lord, why would you subject yourselves to this?
Yeah, bless. I mean, and he knows. He's been with us for a while. He knows the strong feelings.
It was. I thought it was fun, though. Honestly, like I'm excited that we watched it. It was not any better than I remember it. There are a handful of things, though, that are really nice about that movie. And I know that it's got its fans, too. That's the other thing. Like, and I just told somebody that on the YouTube channel this morning, which, by the way, if you don't subscribe to our YouTube channel, do us a favor and go over there and subscribe Articulate Coven on YouTube. Even if you don't actually watch the videos or watch our episodes there, and most of them don't have a video component, we're just an audio show primarily. We're serving the content there, though, because a lot of people, that's their primary way that they interact with podcasts. But also, we're about halfway to the 500 subscriber mark, which will put us eligible for the YouTube Creator Program. So if you'd like to help us out, that's one way to do it. Yeah. We're right at 200.
We got to pimp that out.
Yeah. So go check that out.
That's very exciting.
And join the channel. That'd be helpful to us. But anyway, I commented on somebody's, because they had commented on the post, and they were like, I know I'm like the only one, but I love this movie. I like it better than the 94 Interview with the Vampire movie even. And they gave a couple of reasons. We never like to yuck somebody's yum, right? And we didn't.
No.
Of our poking fun of that movie absolutely is just that. It's in fun. There are things that we find problematic or bothersome about it as an adaptation.
For instance, the lack of Louis completely.
Yeah, and it's something that I'd never considered, honestly, before until I watched it this
either.
Time. And I'm like, he's just not in this.
It's never been like an issue for me before, but I was like, where the fuck? Where's our Eeyore?
Yeah, it's so weird, man. I mean, Claudia either, but if you're not going to have Louis, there's no reason to do the Claudia storyline whatsoever.
No, God, no.
Strange revelation, though, for me that in that universe, Lestat has no Louis. Anyway, all right, tonight, though, we're not talking about another movie, good, bad, or indifferent.
No.
We're going to talk about another book. This is a novel discussion. We're going to talk about the Pandora novel, the first, actually, released in the quote-unquote New Tales of the Vampires. It was something that seemed to be like an ongoing initiative that Anne was going to write two books a year. At least that was the plan for a while. She's going to have a smaller book in the spring and then the big book in the fall that would both continue the Vampire Chronicles. Occasionally she'd throw out a different novel, but primarily at the time she was writing a lot of vampire stuff. I don't think they were that successful, honestly. I think
it's
that's
such
one
a
of the
bummer.
Reasons you only got two of them, you know?
Yeah, it's such a bummer because this is such a great, easy way to expand our like knowledge of the characters, for her to spend more time with the characters and to tell more of our vampires' stories at large. And it's such a bummer. I was so hopeful because I loved this book so much, but then I'll be honest, like, I didn't read Vittorio. I'm like an asshole over here that didn't even do what I was supposed to either.
Well, I got to tell you, I did read it. We'll get to that eventually. It probably will not be our next novel. I'm imagining we'll go into Blood and Gold next, the Marius book, which is a good fit for this. And also, one imagines that we might start getting some teases of those characters, Marius and Pandora and the elder vampires, in this next season of the TV show, too.
And our sad asses have to read the next Mayfair book, too, in preparation for that shit show.
Okay, so I will say, I actually really enjoy Lasher. Lasher is
I do too.
Is especially, and I mean, I'm sure it's problematic now reading it as a 42-year-old man, but the early stuff with Mona in that book is a lot of fun, as I recall. I was 13, 14 when I was reading it. I was her age, basically. And the seduction of Michael that she plays out as she takes control of the family. Spoiler
so
alert.
So messy.
It's and of so course messy. We're not going to get any of that in the series because Rowan's not out of commission. Mona may not even exist. They've sort of
and Michael doesn't exist.
Yeah, and Michael's not there either. I forgot. Yeah. So
yeah. So who knows?
In this week's episode, though, we don't have to worry about adaptations. We just have to worry about what the good lady put on the page. So let's get into it. Let's get into it. Naturally, David, you would leave me something elegant. Pandora. I like the fact that the book opens and for a long time, Pandora talks about the actual physical pages that David has left to her. She talks about the pen and how good it feels writing. Every now and again, Anne lets her own loves shine through her characters. And I think that's very much Anne liked fine notebooks and nice pens.
Oh, I mean, don't we all? I think that there's very few fine things in this world, like a pen that moves the way you want it to on a piece of paper. It's just fucking magical. I love it. I love the way this begins. It's, you know, David approaching her to ask her to tell her story, the story of her life. Like now that he's involved in the vampire world in a more deep way than he was before. He wants to gather all the stories and basically it feels like he wants to create a library of our vampire stories, which I loved the idea of.
Yes, 100% agree. I had forgotten, even since our most recent novel reread of The Vampire Amon, I'd forgotten that David Talbot is the narrator for all of these stories. Or not the narrator, he's the collector of these stories. He's the one in the universe that's writing them all. Lestat writes his first three, Louis writes the very first one, and then after that, it's actually, they're almost all penned by David Talbot, even if they're told by one of the other vampires. You know, the theory in the fandom for a long time has been that in the TV series, we're going to get the characters of David and Daniel sort of combined. And starting this book, I said even more so that's going to be the case. I'm just convinced that our Daniel is going to become the chronicler of the vampires. They can tell any story they want to, even under the same title of Interview with the Vampire, since Daniel is doing the interviewing. You know, Daniel interviews Lestat, Daniel interviews Armand and Pandora or Marius or whatever. Except in those recent trailers, as we've discussed in our regular episodes, seems like maybe we might get David this season. And he's not the same character as Daniel, or at least that's the theory currently. Justin Long is in the trailer as an unknown character of the appropriate age to be a David. So I don't know how that's going to play out, but I do think it is important for our adaptations as we move forward that David is at the center of all those adaptations. I think that's going to be used in the series somehow.
Well, I feel like either way they go with that, if they give us a scaled down version of David, and then kind of the storytelling is taken over by our Daniel Malloy as a grown adult man as opposed to like the shit show that was the Devil's Minion, then I like that. I would be fine with that. But I am also excited at the prospect of getting David Talbot. You and I are both big fans of that character.
There's so much about David that I like. I mean, obviously, he is problematic in lots of ways. We talked about some of those in the Vampire Armand discussion. But I love David. If they bring him, I said, by the way, Justin Long earlier. It's Justin Kirk, excuse me. Best known for me by, it's not the, I'm a Mac guy. Justin Kirk is best known by me for Weeds. He was the dopey brother-in-law on Weeds.
Excellent. Justin Long. I didn't even catch that. I was not paying close enough attention.
I missed it too, except I look further down on my notes. I'm like, I didn't say Justin Kirk.
whoops.
Okay. Can I tell you?
Okay. So
I am super excited to see truly old vampires on our TV show. Armand is one thing, and we've already got him to a degree. We're going to get a lot of him this next season. But Pandora and Marius. Even folks like Kamen and Maharet, you know, the level of power and brutality that they bring is different. It's also, most of them predate most religions, right? And the books and our main characters are very interested in those topics. So it's going to be fun to see the juxtaposition and to hear those philosophical discussions. If the Talamasca show can work, if they get that off the ground, I hope that we get an Elder Vamp spinoff eventually as well, you know. It'd be post Queen of the Damned is my guess. Once you've gotten the reveal of how the origin story plays out. But after that, you know, we've talked previously, Amiris and Pandora show would be perfect, I feel like, because through them, you could also get glimpses of other vamps, and you could get a lot of origin stories, right, and get lots of flashbacks to different periods, and then follow them through different periods as well. Anyway, I, you know, these ancient vampires, especially when you get to the Children of the Millennia, they're like walking nuclear bombs, right? And I love that.
They have so
idea.
Much power and right. strength. You never know quite what's gonna set one of them off, to be honest, you know. And they can create quite a bit of destruction. They can leave a lot of destruction in their wake, physically, emotionally, all of the above.
The opening of this book is interesting because it tags on to the end of the Armand book a little bit. David's talking about those that believed in Veronica's veil. What a consolation it must be to accept such a thing so easily. I thought that was a great line. I had a college professor who told me one time that he would have given anything to have been able to change places philosophically and theologically with my grandmother, who was just 100% assured of the good old time religion. You know, he said, if I could get up in the morning and just know what my purpose is in the world and what's to come next and how this is all going to play out and et cetera, et cetera. Oh, I would have loved it. I don't have any of that certainty, but I would love it. I don't know.
There'd be zero anxiety. I mean, you would have like, but it also feels so simple. It feels like a very... But that's not bad. Simple isn't bad. But my brain is way too confused and questioning and all of that to fall into that category, unfortunately.
Well, and David follows that up. He's talking about going back to the Talamasca, theoretically. He says, I thought philosophy would provide a bridge so that I could walk between both worlds. But there is no bridge. Even for David, it's like, humans are humans and vampires are vampires and never the twain shall meet.
Right. Except for where they meet all the time. Usually at Lestat's mouth.
Yeah. It does not end well for the humans as a rule. Okay. What is Pandora's family name? Is there a Roman ruling family that I'm not thinking of? And hints that we should know this. It's the indication there is that she's not telling us to protect, you know, the innocent, so to speak, but right. that if you knew about Roman history, we would all go, oh my, if we realized actually who she is.
Well, I think that for both of us, probably at this point in our lives, the Vampire Chronicles are our Roman Empire, quote unquote.
Yes.
So, unfortunately, I don't think about the Roman Empire once a day, and I don't know a lot about it, but that's one of the reasons why I love this book so much, is that it sort of reminds me of the fact that, hello, Ashley, you really do enjoy some historic fiction. And this is a great little look into this life that they're living in Rome. And it sounds amazing at first. You know, it's like, it's beautiful. She's really happy. She's allowed to read and write. And she's beloved by her father and her brothers, except for the one asshole. And, you know, she's very independent. She doesn't, you know, she loves being herself and who she is. I don't think until, aside from being very taken with Marius, she isn't very interested in being married off to the highest bidder or what have you. So she's a very interesting character in a time where women were allowed a lot more freedom than, you know, between now and then, I guess.
Yes. Well, you and I have talked about this previously with her, the suggestion, or her suggestion, at least her belief, that she had lived previously. She'd lived previous
yes.
lives. And she is the quote unquote old soul, even from a very young age. I will say, Marius falling in love with 10-year-old Pandora is no bueno.
It's very Marius. It's very Marius, though. It's very on brand for our Marius.
Let's close that age gap a little bit, maybe.
God, you know? Bless. Like, it's very alarming.
My
hope is that they wouldn't have let her get married at the age of 10, but when it was age appropriate, then she would be able to marry him. But her daddy's like, hell no, not him. He's trouble.
So I think... So at first, I, because she's kind of falls for him the very first time that she sees him. She's like 10 years old. He comes back later and apparently insinuates her ass outright if they could be betrothed. And she's like 12 or 13, I think, at that point. So it's at least a few years later. But I mean, my kids watch Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace, and they sort of ugh when Natalie Portman and Jake, what's his face, are supposed
Lloyd.
To be Jake Lloyd are supposed to be future love interests, and there's a 6 year age gap or an 8 year age gap maybe there.
Right, it's not a real offensive one. It's just that he's a tiny little boy.
Yeah, and she's like not a very old teenager, but he is actual child.
An actual child.
Yeah. Less close the age gap is all I'm saying. This series,
I agree.
The beauty of Pandora, I think, one of the wonderful things about her as a character is that she gets so much human life. You know, she lives for quite a long time compared to most of our other characters. Lestat in the books, I think, is barely 20. You know, Louis is just over 20. Armand's like 14, 15 years old in the novels. So most of these characters, most of our main characters, are fairly young. Maharet is still pretty young as well, even though she's an ancient vampire. Pandora is like a 40-year-old woman before she's turned.
Right.
You know, she's a grown woman. Already past the prime where no one is honestly hustling her to get married anymore, as you mentioned.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, she lives a lot of life, too. Like, you know, her entire family is slaughtered when they're betrayed by her brother. And has to leave everything she's ever known behind and sail away to a new place where she's hopefully will be safe. And one thing I love about this character is just how ballsy she is. She's just, and that's why it's so frustrating when you see her represented later, that she's so like withdrawn and in herself, and because she's so vibrant in this book, she's so interesting and interested in everything. She wants to learn everything. She wants to touch everything, feel everything, smell everything, see everything. And it's such a bummer that they're like, oh, she got sad because of men. I mean,
well, it's indicative of Anne's ability to write women, I think, though. She's just,
well, that's very true.
She's just so bad at it, honestly.
Yeah, it's not her best, but I will say, I think that's one thing I really love about Pandora is I feel like she's a really well-rounded character as far as, like, she wrote this after she had already kind of created these conventions about Pandora's character, about her being sullen and quiet and kind of not really engaging with anyone. She wrote this after she kind of already established that. So I think maybe she even realized there was more life in this character than she thought.
Yes. Yeah. And it is a shame that she never got back to it. You know, you feel like there's another novel between, as you said, like, why does she end up kind of a sad sack in the modern day? She makes reference to the one scene later where she and Maria see each other, and she was with a vampire who had the forcefulness or the willfulness or whatever to carry her through that age, is the way that she put it.
Right.
But still, like, you can't find better companions. Hang out with some female vampires. There's a bunch of them out
right.
there.
Right. Jesus, make one, girl.
Yeah,
make
exactly.
a friend. My God, she's got good sense. She make a good friend. She wasn't turning people into vampires left, right, and center.
So
like, turned her like her best guy into one, and only because he was almost dying.
So what do you think of the reincarnation of it all? You know, so she eventually unlocks through her worship of Isis and some rituals and some psychoactive drugs. She unlocks the these memories of not only a former mortal life, but she was turned into a vampire in a previous life as well. In the broader context of Anne's, you know, universe and her pantheon, so to speak. What do you think about this? How do you feel like this fits?
I love it. I think it's got kind of a, it sort of kind of goes along with the sort of, what am I trying to say? Like the origin story even of the vampires, you know, with Egypt, ancient Egypt and, you know, rebirth and reincarnation being such a part of, you know, you get sent to the to the underworld with belongings and things you're going to need in your next life. So it sort of, to me, makes sense. And it kind of, it has like a kind of a mummy feel to it. You know, this book feels very different than most of the Vampire Chronicles, for sure. It's not as, it's, I mean, it's so a book unto itself, and it's not, it doesn't need a lot of input from the other characters that we're always, that we're already so familiar with. So it just feels so different because, you know, Lestat's not in this. Louis's not in this. We're not really seeing anyone we know except Marius. And so it sort of gives us a different, it definitely gives you a different opinion on Marius. This is a totally different relationship than we see Marius in at all. He's with an equal with her, which is a very interesting place for him to be because he's not comfortable being with an equal. He doesn't want a partner that he can share equally his burdens and everything with. It's like he's so self-suffering, he feels like he needs that for himself.
That's a good way to put it. Well, you talk about separated from the rest of the series. Vittorio the Vampire, even more so. You know, that's the novel that follows this up, yeah, as right. far as release schedule goes. And in that one, I think in the opening chapter, Vittorio says something along the lines of, I know nothing of Lestat
about your
and
vampires.
His coven of the Articulate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know those vampires. I don't know anything about their story. I wasn't involved. Which is crazy when you think about the events of Queen of the Damned, for instance, that literally unite the world. I thought everybody knew, right? They all heard about Marius, and they all saw the videos, and they were all connected to this moment with the queen. Not so much for Vittorio, apparently. And, like Pandora, he brings in some aspects of the supernatural that are not really touched on in the other novels. I'm pretty sure this is Vittorio sees spirits where none of the other vampires
right.
can. So it's interesting. And of course, that comes up later in the books. Where you haven't read the final Prince Lestat trilogy, but in the Prince Lestat trilogy, there are some more elements of the supernatural that come in. Pandora does not play that big a role in those novels, but it is interesting that even here, and sort of hinting at the broader supernatural world. And I like when she does that. I also think that those sorts of things will absolutely come to play in the series as it moves on, hopefully the TV series itself. Okay, let's talk a little bit about her betrayal, the family's betrayal, and why she ends
yes.
up where she goes to, and why she ends up, you know, refinding Marius and all of this. It starts because her family's in a hard way. Her brother literally abandons them, betrays them, rats out the dad, and then runs. Takes the 30 pieces of silver, so to speak, and runs.
Piece of shit.
I love that he confronts her like it's her fault for being there. Like, shame on you for coming to weren't you supposed to be dead?
To where I was hiding out? Are you supposed to be dead?
Yeah. But then the way that she turns on him.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Okay, so he's caroning big time, and it, you know, brings the cops to catch her. She sweet talks the cops into killing him instead.
Into killing him
right there
instead.
On the fucking street. It's amazing.
It's so brilliant. And it just, like, that's part of why this character is so interesting to me, because she is one of the few characters, female characters that Anne created, that has this sort of depth and a little bit of, like, almost, I mean, this wasn't like a fun edge, but there is fun in her. She has a spirit of fun and a spirit of adventure, and it's so, I love that turn. I had forgotten how good it was until this reread. Like, I hadn't read this in a long time, and I had just forgotten how satisfying it is, because he's such a piece of shit and he's such a weak child, and it's so fantastic. I love that she gets to show off how smart she is, how educated she is, how she knows how to use her feminine wiles in addition to all of that. But also, being a fucking grown-ass adult woman, she has a certain amount of power. She's rich. She's, you know, presenting as a wealthy woman in this town. And so it's just, it's great to see a woman use all of her gifts and skills to really get what they want.
Yes.
Not that lasts long, but hey, you know,
well, it works. Well, but the interesting thing too there is that I feel like it shows some of Pandora's brutality, right? She doesn't just have him arrested or just get the cops to leave her alone. She has him murdered right there in front of her.
Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, but like, as a vampire, we see her often in this novel and others like not just eat someone, but rip them apart and take their heart out and suck their heart mm-hmm. in front of them, you know, and things like that. Not a yeah. whole lot of the vampires that we quote unquote root for do that sort of thing very often. Pandora does it a lot. So,
well, she doesn't have to either. It's like she's just as old and like she is drank from a Akasha. Like it's not like she's got to go running around eating her fill, but man, she will get messy. She will play with her food.
So when we finally get the reunion with Marius, and I love, by the way, that he like sneaks in and they're all like, oh my God, who is this? Who could it be? And she is just, again, not worried at all. He's totally different. He's clearly transformed. She notices it right away. Not irked, not nervous. Yeah. She's just like, this is my yeah. boy. What's up, Marius?
It's my guy. I've been wanting to hang with you for a minute.
But she's yeah. got a great line. She says, this transformation, it's added no inches to your height. Did it add any inches anywhere else?
Yes. And this is, again, we've talked about this. This is the only vampiric pairing that actually has physical intercourse as a human would. This is the only that I can think of that's mentioned, aside from, you know, Lestat going down on Gretchen.
So there's one later in the books, but it's very clinical. Is in the Prince Lestat trilogy, there's a session with Lestat that is augmented, let's just say that, and he describes it as very clinical. Even here, Marius doesn't seem very interested, right? Like she goes for it and he's like, right. Nah, it's not like that anymore. And she's like, yeah, it is, motherfucker.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is, sir.
She yeah. is definitely our horniest vampire. Horniest and our
like
cheekiest.
It.
I do too.
I like it. I love her. I had this giant ass cat that I was given around this time that was a huge, that turned into a huge tortoiseshell calico. She was very small and a kitten when she was given to me. But I named her Pandora, and she was a badass motherfucker and was so much fun to have around and was, you know, definitely lived up to her name.
So here's something that I had not noticed the first time that I read this book, but in the shadow of the TV series, we've been talking about the groan that they hear in the building there in Dubai. Yeah. When Pandora first arrives at Marius's house, she hears a sound, a groaning sound, as she describes it, from somewhere deep in the building. I wonder if those are connected.
I you know, maybe we'll find out here in less than 2 weeks, Joel.
I want to talk about Flavius. Okay, so Pandora's she buys this man, an older man who is trained as a teacher, among other things, and he becomes, you know, her primary servant in her new household here. And then she brings him over when she and Marius begin to dally too. We talked earlier, Anne is not great at female characters. What she is great at is bringing in a character like this, a minor character. He doesn't even appear that much throughout the entire novel, but it's immediately beloved by the main characters, right? And the reader as well. I love Flavius has always got a good line. He's
fantastic.
Down the clown, right? Like he sees the change in them and is just fine with it. Yep. Okay. We're
he's
rolling.
Also always right where he fucking needs to be.
Right.
Like it. He is where he needs to be at any given time. Like, that is a man who takes care of his business and your business as well. If you are a vampire and you need a good right-hand man, may I recommend Flavius?
But also, okay, let's get back to the total cheekiness of this chick. She says, Marius had forbidden making new vampires, and I never questioned him. He left, and I immediately made Flavius a vampire.
Yep, yep. I was like, sure, bet. We won't make any new ones. Bye-bye.
I mean, no, we won't make any new ones after him. That's
After that.
You meant
that's
after
what
Flavius.
You meant.
Yeah.
That's what you meant. That's what you meant. Yep. I was very happy that happened. It makes me very sad that he leaves and we don't see him again.
Well, it's one of those things that, if this character even makes it into the series somewhere, you feel like they might could do a little change up like they did with Killer in season one. And he could absolutely show up at a later point.
Oh, for sure.
You know? And especially in the Prince Lestat books, there are all sorts of reasons to bring back anybody from the long cast of characters. So I think it's absolutely a possibility if we get this character at all. And listen, if there is a Marius and Pandora spinoff, then Flavius needs to be their houseboy 100%. Flavius has got to be
there. Yeah, I want plenty of screen time for that if that happens. I just keep picturing the Marius and Pandora spinoff is like a piece of WandaVision. Like, yes. It's some sort of weird, fucked up kind of sitcom of their lives.
Well, but if you think about the mirror, okay, so our main series, at least the way that it's been built, the way that it's been promoted, it's built on the love affair, the relationship between Lestat and Louis, and how we're going to see that play out over the centuries. These two lived together for 200 years,
yeah.
Lived together and argued basically continuously. Louis and Lestat would never have made it 2 centuries.
Not without one of them burning something down.
Yeah, not one of them. We know who burns things
Louis.
Down.
Not without Louis burning the house down. Oh, man.
So what is it for somebody who hasn't read this novel and who generally just follows along with our novel episodes because they're like, yeah, I'm not into that. This is a fairly short read, Ashley.
It is.
It's such a great character. One of Anne's few female lead characters, and especially in the VC novels. Make the pitch. What is it about Pandora that you find so captivating even now?
I've spoken a lot about it already, kind of, but I think part of it is seeing what in our, like, a little bit more of a heteronormative relationship is kind of interesting in this world that we don't see very often in this vampire world, which is awesome, I've got to say. I think that's one of the reasons why I connected to her. I was like, oh, this could be a little bit like me in this world. She's just, the curiosity and her fearlessness are just things that I loved so much about the character. She's curious and she wants to know. She wants to understand. She wants to, like, part of this is Marius gets so angry because she becomes just fascinated and obsessed with those who must be kept, and he hates it on so many levels, but she can't pull herself away from it because she's just so drawn in and wants to know more, wants to serve, wants to be a part of. I think that's another part too, you know, she was part of this huge, beautiful Roman Empire that was so glorious, and I think a lot of it is her searching for that kind of community, belonging, and after not finding it for so long, maybe that is why she becomes so withdrawn and morose and sad in a way. I also think we get to learn so much about Marius through Pandora. And I was, when Marius first showed up in these books, I was immediately taken by that character. And so getting to learn more about Marius, getting to learn about the kind of woman Marius would fall in love with, mortal Marius, like Marius himself as a man would fall in love with. I think all of that is just fascinating to me and made this just a must read for me.
Yeah, I do think it's a must read. I would probably put this fourth or fifth maybe on my favorite of the novel, maybe even lower than that, honestly. But we're about to get into the stretch that I haven't reread a million times. You know,
right.
When we get into the Merricks and the Blackwood Farms, for instance, I recall really enjoying those, but I haven't read them a dozen times, so I don't know where they're going to fall on the total ranking. But the shades that are added to the overall narrative of this chronicle by this story in particular and Pandora's version of it. A lot of people are like, well, we hear parts of this in The Vampire Lestat. We hear a lot of it in Blood of Gold. Like, why
but
do I need to hear
like
it again?
This.
It's not, it is different. It's very different. And
it
I
is.
Think
it's,
you
and
benefit
it's,
from seeing all those shades.
Yeah. And it's told through a lens of it's like she's happy to be going back and remembering all of this. And even at the end of this book, she feels reinvigorated at the end of this novel. Like this talking, writing and not talking, I guess writing all of this out for David has gotten her like, well, maybe there is more to this world that we're living in that I've been here for millennia and I still want more. I can seek more. There's more to find. There's more to explore. I love that.
Man, but isn't that true in our own lives? Like, don't we, when we sit down and make a list of the thing, my wife and I were talking about this the other day. Like, I was running through a list of things that if you had told me about my business and the projects that I do today, if you told me that 5-6 years ago, how many of them not only would I be surprised by, but like ecstatic about, right?
Right.
And I think too often in life, no matter how you progress, no matter what you're doing, when you're doing it every day, it all becomes normal. It all becomes banal, you know? And so when you lay it out in a chronological sequence of events like that, when you tell your own story, even to yourself, all of a sudden you're like, well, hell, this is a pretty good ride, isn't it?
Right, right. And oh, I've been through some shit and I've come out on the other side okay. Like, I'm okay. I'm an okay person. I am safe. I am awesome. I didn't hurt anyone too badly. And man, if you can get through 2,000 plus years and feel that way, I think you're doing pretty fucking good for yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing along those lines that I feel like this novel does a good example or does a good job of, and we've talked about this a little bit with Lestat and Louis, you know, the long game of an immortal relationship. These characters fall in and out of love, as it were, and can and can't stand to be in the same presence with each other at different times. And yet, part of the reason why that works is because they do know the other one will be around in another 100 years or another 1,000 years or another 2,000. And so I'm not going anywhere and neither are you. Like, it'll be the right time again later.
Yeah, it's enough to know that you endure and I endure and eventually our paths are going to cross again. It's inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something very romantic about that, honestly. And I think that had to have been appealing to Anne, you know, having faced loss so young with her daughter and then having to bury Stan near the end, you know, the love of her life. I think absolutely that's a message that we can all get excited about. Ashley, there's a small thing here at the end of the book that I was in the middle of writing my note about, like, what the hell is this? And it's so weird that she would stick this in here as the coda. And then I remembered, oh, no, wait, that does pay off. Okay, so there is basically like the last thing in the book. She's like, oh, and one more thing. And I hesitate to even mention this because I don't really understand it. But this one time I saw a ghost come out of a beehive. And like, she's like, and I don't know what that was. I never saw it.
I'm not really sure what that was. Maybe you could work that out for me, David.
Literally leaves it hanging out there. Okay, it is so strange though, because this book is written in like 98, 99, and she does not come back to give us any idea of what the heck that means or what it's about until the Prince Lestat novels. I think it's the second Prince Lestat novel. It may be the third even before we get any indication of what that was and what that was about and what its meaning is in the broader tale. But it does pay off. Like, the lady is thinking in a long time span, and it is cool to see that even in her, you know, the plotting of her novels and how she came in and out of writing about this world even, and would turn that spigot off for years at a time. Even still, these little ideas kept buzzing up.
Well, I don't feel like she ever loses track of her narrative. You know, like, she created this world. She knows the world. She can obviously change it. She could obviously change it whenever she liked, make it different whenever she wanted. Obviously, it's her world, but I mean, she had it sussed out so well that it's like almost like the characters can live and breathe and exist there without her having to do much. But it's one of those things like you would never run into in her books. Not that I've ever noticed something like Rachel having 3 different birthdays on Friends, like 3 different birth dates in 3 different zodiac signs on right. Friends, you know, like the, like those kind of like errors in the universe don't happen when the universe is literally in your brain, on your page, from your pen, from your hand, you know, like she was so good about keeping her continuity together. And if she had to make an excuse for something, she would make a character excuse for it. You know, if she wanted to do something a different way, she'd make a character make a decision to make it a different way.
Well, if you're interested in that sort of aspect of her storytelling, or interested in learning how she did it for your own storytelling purposes, go back in our archives. There's an episode I did early on by myself about the Alpha Battery that was released. Yeah. Beckett, her Anne's assistant at the time, put this together. It's basically an updated version of the Vampire Companion that Catherine Ramsland had done years before. But the opening of the Alpha Battery is a long section, a long foreword by Anne, where she describes in graphic detail her own worlds of imagination. Now, we obviously know this one. There's a separate universe of the, well, I say a separate, it's connected, I suppose. The Mayfair Witches are connected. And then there are other, you know, universes that she had, like her werewolf stories and her Mummies. Angel stories, the mummy, all disconnected kind of from these tales. But also, she had a private imaginary world with 60 some odd years of storytelling that she maintained literally just inside herself. It is fascinating to read about the way that this started for her and how she maintained it and what it added to her storytelling. But there is a very clear example. This beehive ghost is going to come up again, and we're going to get there eventually, folks.
It's going to be thousands of pages in the future, y'all. Thousands of pages. But we will get there, by God.
Literally like 15 years, too. It's like,
right, absolutely.
Almost two decades between those two novels.
Can I sit here at almost 45 and tell you that I can remember an idea I had when I was 30? Absolutely not.
Yeah, even if I had charted it out, I don't believe I'd be able to.
A little seed I planted at the end of a book.
What was I going to do with the beehive ghost? I don't even remember. A beehive ghost?
It's like waking up in the middle of the night, like when I used to wait tables, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh, shit, I forgot to take ranch to table 52. And that's like she woke up in the middle of the night and was like, oh, shit, I forgot about Pandora's beehive ghost.
That's it.
Get on with it.
Oh, the beehive. All right, beehive. That's our discussion of Pandora the novel, the first of the new tales of the vampires from Anne Rice. Our next novel that we're going to be discussing is going to be Marius's story, Blood and Gold. But we're not going to get there for quite a while because we've got a season two ahead of us.
Oh my God, y'all, it's almost here.
So, Ashley, the word is on May 5th, we're going to get a first look at season two. It's only going to be about 5 minutes or so on AMC, but my thought is that we would try to combine a Q&A episode and a discussion of that look into season two as well. So, if you've got questions for us about the show, about the novels, about ourselves, whatever you want to ask, let us know. Put those on our Facebook page, put those on the YouTube channel under this video or whatever, and we'll collate those and get together after Ashley and I have seen that behind the scenes special, and we'll do an episode on those things as we prepare for season two's launch on the 12th. Ashley, I told you off air, I will share this with the fans. My guess is that we're going to get season two's premiere early, maybe a day early, maybe a few days early, like they did season, you know, we got season one on like a Wednesday when we were supposed to get it on Friday or something like that. I would not be surprised if they do a similar thing just because it's going to be good. The reviews are going to be good. The buzz is going to be good. You want that to start building before it's on cable and you know, your average Joe can tune in and watch it. So I would be surprised if we don't get it a couple of days early. If we do, Ashley and I'll try to put our episode together early for you and have it out ASAP. But
because you know we're going to watch it, right? As soon as humanly possible.
I mean, I remember when it came out last year, or not almost 2 years ago now, but when season one dropped early, I messaged you and then immediately hit play on it for the first time. I was like, well, that's my day now, as I'm going to be watching.
Here we go.
So that'll be my day too whenever this comes out. But in general, for season two, our releases will come late in the day on Sunday evenings. So basically coinciding with the cable release, we should get the release on AMC Plus in the mornings on Sunday. Ashley and I'll watch it a time or two and then try to get in a recording for you so that those can be out, so you can watch along with us throughout season two. Once we get through season two, I absolutely want to do some more vampire movies. I don't know that we're going to do commentary tracks. Those take a long time, and I think it's not great for some people if they don't have the time to watch the movie along with us.
Right.
But You know, there's a laundry list of those. I know you and I are both big fans of The Lost Boys. That's definitely got to be in there. The Only Lovers Left Alive, the Jim Jarmusch movie that I mentioned previously.
Yes,
a lot of people have mentioned
that
one too. But there's also, you know, there's the new Abigail that's out in movie theaters right now, which looks
pretty good.
The ballerina
vampire, y'all.
Yeah, right? What was the one? Oh, the Voyage of the Demeter that you mentioned previously.
Yeah, The Last Voyage
Dracula
of the Demeter, yeah.
So there's a lot of them out there. I think this is kind of a golden age, honestly, again, for vampires. We've had a few in the 90s after Interview with the Vampire. There was a rash of other good vampire shows and movies.
Francis Ford Coppola, Dracula, where everyone's so good except for Keanu Reeves.
Hey, listen.
And I know we don't talk shit about Keanu anymore because he's beloved, but he's the only not great thing in that movie.
He is not great in that movie. That is absolutely. That's another good one, though, that we should absolutely talk about. The production.
Oh yes, 100%
on that movie is amazing. So
my God,
there you go. Tell us some movies you'd like us to watch once we get through season two here of Interview with the Vampire. Tell us some questions that you have, and get ready with us to enjoy season two of Interview with the Vampire on AMC and AMC Plus. It's coming May 12th, folks. Until we talk to you again, we've been your hosts. I'm Joel.
I'm Ashley.
And we are the Articulate Coven. Thanks for listening to the Articulate Coven. You can join our community on Facebook by following the links in the show notes or searching for Articulate Coven on Facebook. You can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at articulatecoven.com. And share us with your Anne Rice-loving friends.